Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to the Soldiers of Cinema podcast. I'm Clark Coffey, and with me, as always, is the super groovy Cullen McVader.
I thought you were waiting for me there for a second. I was going to say something.
No, you know, I should do some preparation, you know, aside from watching the film that we're going to be covering today. I feel like I need to give some extra time to come up with some really, really worthy descriptors, adjectives for you. You know, now
we'll
that this has become
GPT,
a thing.
We can say, like, give us 18 million descriptors for other podcast hosts, and then we can just go down the list. We'll never run out.
So you're suggesting I should just use AI to come up with content here on our podcast. I don't know. I mean, maybe we could just we could ask AI to create a film for us, and then we could ask the same AI to create a podcast for us discussing the film that it created, and then we just sit back and do nothing.
And we'd get jobs at Sony or something. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that's, yeah, of course, easy. It's easy. No problem. Well, anyway, I guess because, you know, in the past, it had kind of become this running meme, but maybe I'm pushing it now. Maybe I'm pushing it. I don't know.
No, I think we're into it. I think we've got to double down.
Is it okay? We double down? Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Fair. I mean, I feel like groovy because it's when I see the stash, I think groovy. It takes me back to the 70s, which I know you didn't live through. And frankly, really, neither did I. I was, you know, 4 years old by the time I was out of the 70s. So I really don't remember any of it. But I feel like, you know, the stash reminds me of the 70s, which takes me to groovy. And then I just didn't want it to be groovy, Cullen McVader, because I feel like you're super as well. So
yeah,
there you have
it. Well, it's a little Starsky and Hutch kind of thing.
Right? You know what? I could see you in like a reboot of that, dude. I could totally see that. Anyway, sorry, listeners, for it taking so long just to get to the start of our the real meat of our podcast, which is our discussion of my selection for the week, The New World. Terrence Malick's 2005 film.
Curious man, Smith. What is it that you're looking for?
I've always believed that something good was in store for me. Destiny all my own.
First hour.
We could leave this place together.
I picked this because I know Cullen's a huge fan of Mr. Malick and his work. And I also picked it because I had not seen this film maybe since its like release on home video. So we can kind of jump in then to mm-hmm. personal experiences. And, you know, let me start with mine since I'm already grooving in that direction, right? Speaking of groove, speaking of groovy. Way back when this film was released, I didn't go see it in the theater. And I have no recollection as to why, and who knows, I don't know. I just didn't go see it. And I think, to be frank, at the time, my level of exposure to Malick was maybe The Thin Red Line, and that was it. And I really didn't have any kind of strong connection or association with him as a director. And so when this film was released, it didn't like jump out at me, I guess. Mm-hmm. So then when it was released on home video, I still didn't even run out and go grab it. Actually, one of my roommates at the time, I had just moved to Southern California, and I lived in a house with a couple roommates. And it was actually one of my roommates who went out and rented it. And I mean, I had no part in the selection of the film or anything at all. And so, you know, he was like, oh, hey, I rented this movie. You guys want to watch it with me? And I'm like, okay, sure. Why not? You know? And so it was kind of one of those experiences where it's like, you have no expectations. I didn't even know what the movie was. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, we're going to watch The New World. I'm like, okay, sure. Whatever. And, you know, and I had a really interesting experience with the film. So first of all, I was just totally mesmerized by the film. It was like really a viewing experience that stands out in my memory of watching films. So kudos. I don't want to like just, you know, say somebody's name who like doesn't necessarily maybe want to be public. I don't know. But roommate, you know who you are. Thank you so much for exposing me to this film. You have great taste, sir. So thank you. Shout out to Rumi. He's a good dude. But so check this out. This is also kind of funny. So here's it's like, this is kind of interesting to me. Maybe this will be boring, but okay. So my roommate, he bought, like, we live in this crappy house, right? It's a crappy old house. And, he bought this, you remember those huge like rear projection TVs like Mitsubishi used to make, you know, yeah, they're 480, but it was like 60 inches or something, which would have been huge for back then. Yeah. So it's like this large, but ridiculously crappy image quality.
And they
right?
were like 4.3 deep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like 4.3, 480i. Every little ounce of resolution is stretched across this huge screen. So it's like the scan lines are just like, you know, an inch, like, you know what I mean? And he also had grabbed this like used like AV receiver from somewhere, Craigslist mm-hmm. or something. Right. And so picture quality, not great. And the sound was like super weird. You know how sometimes if you have like a 5.1 or some kind of surround mixed and it's not like set correctly, or you don't have the right speaker set up or something, and it can be like hard to, like the dialogue gets lost in the mix or something. I don't know if you've ever experienced mm-hmm. that.
But yeah. It's like, it's condensing the five into two or something.
Super weird. Hey, something super weird. And so I'm watching the film and I could not hardly understand any of the dialogue, but especially the narration. The mm-hmm. way the narration is kind of laid into the mix and the way the setup was, I would just grab like words here and there of the narration. I couldn't make it out. And normally I'd be like, whoa, we got to change this. Like, I can't, you know, I'm missing something here in the film. This is unacceptable. But for whatever reason, I didn't. And I think it was because it just like, somehow even added something more to the film. Mm-hmm. It made it even like more of this, like of a mystical experience almost. So I just focused on the images, and it almost played for me almost like a silent film, or at least like a film without dialogue. And it was just an extraordinary experience. It left a huge impression on me. Malick's style of filmmaking was something that I hadn't really experienced at that point in my life. And it just blew me away. I mean, that, mm-hmm. so from an emotional perspective, before we get into the technical stuff, it was extremely moving, and it was really kind of broadened my expanses on, you know, especially because this is a studio film. It's like Christian Bale, it's Colin Farrell. It's like, whoa, you know, this, it feels like it's going to be this blockbuster type movie, right? You think it's going to be, you know, some kind of epic adventure, you know, or something like
a live
this.
Action Pocahontas.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or that. Yeah. Whatever. But of course it's not even remotely close to that. Mm-hmm. And it really does kind of almost veer into like an, you know, experimental film, which is what all of his films after this one have been kind of labeled by the press, which is interesting. So that's mm-hmm. my personal experience. It was, before we get, like I said, just technical, just speaking from an emotional perspective, I was just blown away by it emotionally, just found it extraordinary. So yeah, there you go. There's my personal experience with the film. What about you?
Yeah, I, you know, as you mentioned earlier, like I'm a big fan of Malick. He's arguably my favorite director, or if not up there.
Yeah.
And I, like this movie in particular as well, would be one of, I mean, definitely, I love all of his movies. There's not really any that I don't like. So it's kind of a fool's errand of me to even try and pick out which one would
you
be
don't
my
need
favorite.
To.
But I think
we're not going to push you to.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. But I think that if I, you know, in terms of the ones that I've seen the most or connect with the most on sort of like that emotional level, it definitely would be The Thin Red Line, this, and Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, I mean, which he did all in a row.
Yeah.
I think that we did The Thin Red Line. I was thinking about it that when we reviewed that movie would be, God, it was like 4 years ago now. It was 2020, which this.
We chose this in 4 years ago? Thin Red Line. We did
Thin
four
Red Line.
Years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so I was thinking about it because I was like, it's funny because we've only done one other Malick movie, even though he's one of my favorites. I've always kind of been hesitant to choose another one because I'm like, I don't want to do a repeat so quick. But then I was like, oh, wait, it's been four years.
Yeah.
But, and so I think that this is a,
you were in middle school when we did that one.
No. Exactly. Yeah. Now I'm in high school. I'm almost a senior. But I think that this is really interesting because it's almost like a evolution of that into something that I think a lot of people know Malick as, where there's this weird thing where it's like, you know, back in the 70s, his movies were pretty formalistic. He had a lot of the tendencies of like the narration and things like that, but Badlands is a pretty straightforward story. Even Days of Heaven, you're getting into that kind of meandering monologue thing. But I remember watching those and sort of thinking, okay, this is still pretty formal. Like it's still mm-hmm. shot like pretty standard.
There's a standard narrative that you can kind of as an audience member grab onto.
Yeah,
and it doesn't feel too like you don't feel too unmoored as like a viewer in those earlier films.
And so then watching when I watched, you know, this and The Thin Red Line and Tree of Life, I think would have been the first one of the three that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Like I think one of the things that really sparked an interest in me was just the fact that you like kind of like you said, where it's like this big studio picture, you've got this big budget, you've got these, you know, A-list stars,
right,
in what kind of amounts to a challenging of blockbuster or big budget filmmaking in that sense. Not that this is a blockbuster, but
no,
you just don't see formalistic challenges like in the way that Malick does them here, in terms of just kind of throwing out narrative convention. And
right.
I remember actually quite recently I was teaching a class to like a film class, and I showed moments from a bunch of Malick's films to kind of express this idea of like, you know, filmmaking through feeling and emotion as opposed to plot and writing and getting things in the audience's head via words and, you know, specific action. And I remember kind of my prelude to showing them Malick clips was sort of saying like, don't try and work out what is going on in each scene from a literal sense. just look at the images and listen to the sounds and listen to the words that the characters are speaking and feel something. And yeah. whatever you are feeling from those words and sounds
go for the
like
ride.
That is likely right. Like you're likely on a very basic emotional level in the right place. Because right. I think that that's the challenge I think a lot of people have with getting it. And I certainly felt that getting into Malick, even though I always really liked him, it was a challenge to get emotionally connected for me for a while because of the fact that I think I was looking too specifically at like, okay, well, what's this character doing in this scene? Why does this matter?
Interesting.
Why? And so I found that, you know, as I got older and as I rewatched a lot of his movies and things like that, especially here, especially with the extended cut here too, because there's even more meandering, so to say, in this movie of the characters. And I think I sort of started to look at them a different way and realize that, okay, whatever I'm just feeling is right. I don't have to understand and it kind of goes back to what you were saying about how like the dialogue wasn't audible and that the narration yeah. wasn't audible. And yet you still had an experience with the movie and it's like, okay, yeah, because that's not really the point.
I mean, arguably a better experience, interestingly enough. So I want to pause you here. Because I don't want to lose this before we start, you know, really getting into the nitty gritty of it. So just in case I missed it. So when did you see this film roughly ish? Like,
don't remember. I think it was probably around.
So you don't have like a solid recollection of your first.
Yeah. I do remember my feelings seeing it the first time. It was probably when I was in like grade 11 or grade 12. So, okay.
And you'd been, and you said which you were familiar with Malick and his work.
Yeah. So
by
I'd
the time you saw this
Tree of Life, I'd seen when I was much younger. I saw Tree of Life around the time of release.
Okay. And that was your first Malick film.
Yeah. And then I remember, like, I think that it was just seeing it. I do remember coming away feeling like positive. You know,
you don't have a strong recollection of it. And so, okay, I'm curious then. So coming back to it now, obviously, so it's almost feels like a little bit of full circle for you in a way, because it sounds like you don't have a strong recollection of having first seen it. You were younger. And but you've become a fan of Malick's. You've seen, you know, I'm assuming all or most of his films at this point. Mm-hmm. So what was your experience this time? I mean, just emotionally, before we get into a technical, because I kind of always like to start from that point where it's like, we're just an audience first, right? Mm-hmm.
No, I felt, yeah. I mean, it's funny to me to be so, like, I was completely hypnotized, so to say. Like, I find that that's what this, in kind of very similar circumstances as like Koyaanisqatsi, which of course we did last
right.
week.
Right, I thought of that too.
You get hypnotized by, you know, I think that's where Malick is so talented, is that he has this ability to have scenes where seemingly nothing is occurring and yet you are brought in. So I think emotionally for me watching it, I was like, you know, unsurprisingly, it wasn't a shock because of course I've seen this movie since as well. And but I think that never an urgency to like look away from the screen. In fact, at one point when I can't remember what I had to get up, I think I was just like refilling my water or something. And sometimes if I'm watching a movie and I'm not, you know, I just am literally walking 3 feet sideways and filling it up from the sink, I paused this because I was like, I don't want to miss a frame of the movie. So
yeah.
Which is weird for a movie that it's not like you've got to keep up with a bunch of convoluting twists and turns.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, keep track of all these.
Yeah.
And yet, I think that that's the thing, is like you just, it brings you into this very immersive kind of audiovisual experience, this sort of soundscape, and if you will. And of course, you know, visual.
Right, sure.
Visuals are incredible. But, and I think that that's, if anything, each time I've watched this movie, that's just gotten more certain for me that I've, you know, that I can see it less as a movie that I'm sitting down and watching, and more as something that you kind of like sit down and fall into and just get sucked in for. I mean, this is the extended cut is long too.
It is. And just to clarify too, so we will be talking about the extended cut this film for the duration of this conversation. It's the version, it's the cut that both of us watched in preparation for this discussion. So just to kind of clarify that. Although, I mean, I don't think our discussion would be terribly different if we were discussing another cut, but just for clarification for everybody. I mean, I'm curious, you know, just speaking emotionally, because of Malick's films, of all the films I've seen, and with this one as well, there, I, you know, as I try to kind of find an articulation for the emotions that this film brings up in me when I'm watching it, I mean, there's an interesting, like, melancholy. There's an interesting kind of... It's almost like it's right. There's clearly there's a beauty, but there's kind of like this undercutting melancholy. It's almost like the fleeting nature of things kind of gives it their beauty. There's kind of, I mean, I don't know. It's going to be super cheesy, but there's almost like this existential kind of experience watching these films that, you know, you don't often have watching, you know, especially a more traditionally narrative film. Certainly not from watching a Marvel flick. Yeah, but well, I mean, do you get a sense of this kind of this
totally,
melancholy?
Yeah,
this,
I mean,
this theme that, but it's almost like the beauty is kind of painful. I don't know. Do, I don't know. Does that resonate with you at all, or am I just
well,
making stuff up?
I think
up?
Malick has like a super specific point of view in all of his movies, and he's
right.
super in touch with kind of nature and, and humanity's relationship with nature. Mm. And I think similarly to The Thin Red Line, where it's The Thin Red Line is not really a war movie. It's a movie about humanity that just happens to use a story in war to express those feelings.
Sure.
And this is, you know, this is a movie that takes place during colonial times, and yet the movie is not really specifically about colonialism. It's more about the relationship of man and nature. And I totally get what you mean in terms of this melancholy, where I think that especially the latter half of the film, when Jamestown is actually kind of being established, and and they're kind of through those rough winters, and there's actually a level of like a colony that's self-sufficient, it really starts to get very melancholic. There's a point where you know, you're constantly seeing back to the indigenous people who at the beginning of the film were living that life completely as they were, and yet now you see them farming and trading and selling you know, furs to the settlers, and even living in houses in some instances, as opposed to a much more kind of, you know, bare bones way of living that they would have lived before the settlers. And it does feel very melancholic, because I think Malick's point of view here is that you're like, almost like when you rip yourself out of nature and you kind of build this disconnect between you and nature, as you know, the European settlers have, you die. Like you can't live like that. Like you lose your soul in this sense. And so it is really melancholic, like you said, to see, you don't really know why it's sad, because it's like these characters haven't necessarily literally died when they are now living in houses and trading with and living a more, you know, so to say, European style of living. And yet in the language of the monologues, in the framing of the images, and the way that the film kind of approaches that at that point and changes this tone, you get this sense that something's missing. And we get these constant monologues at that point about like, I feel like I'm disconnected, I feel like I've betrayed my mother, I feel like, you know, and so there's this really, really profound switch in that it's super subtle. I think, you know, another filmmaker approaching this would likely have done it much more upfront and in your face, where it's like, oh, I need to get back out into the woods and see, you know, nature again. And yet this one, it's hard because the characters don't themselves understand it. And so I think it's trying to explore that sort of sense where, which is, you know, the definition of melancholy is a feeling of sadness without really being able to identify the source. And I think that there is absolutely this incredible sense of like, it's looking at this bigger picture, it's using this story,
but it's interesting
Jonestown,
that,
or Jamestown, you know, not Jonestown.
It's so interesting to me. I mean, and again, you know, like I often do, you know, I'm kind of finding my way in an articulation of feelings, you know, live in the moment, so forgive me everyone if you know, if I kind of stumble through that a little bit. It's just I guess the nature of me and how I work. But I mean, it's interesting. I think, you know, even more specifically, it's his use of beauty, of visual, of aesthetic awe to illustrate that growing disconnect. You know, I just find it interesting in a particular way that he does it. I mean, just kind of jump around here, you know, some things that kind of stood out to me. I think there was like a couple, and like I said, this is the first time that I really actually heard the monologue, or, you know, no, sorry, the narration. I didn't really have the narration in my first viewing experience because just, again, the way it's kind of laid in the mix, it was mostly not understandable to me the first, you know, when I first watched this film so many years ago. This time I listened to it with headphones on, so the kind of the surround sound mix thing was not an issue, and it was, you know, boom, being pumped right into my ear. So, you know, everything that was said in the film I understood. There's some like really interesting contrasts, so, you know, with the narration and what's happening in the film. You know, it's kind of like when Colin Farrell's character, when John Smith, he's narrating and they're kind of coming into the land, and he's, you know, is this just, I forget exactly, I can't quote it exactly, but there's almost this very strong contrast or irony between what he's saying about, you know, free men being able to make their way and that this land is rich and theirs for the taking, kind of. Well, of course, we have the hindsight of knowing exactly what happened to the indigenous people who lived here, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this irony of like him seeing it as this wonderful blessing. You know, if you work hard, you know, you can, you'll be this, you know, your stature will be recognized, or all of these kind of things. Well, of course, we know what the cost of that was, ended up being for the people who already were living on that land, right? I don't think that's accidental. There's other interesting ironies between the narration and what's happening on screen. I if you remember this, I feel like, you know, again, it's hard to kind of place in the quote unquote story where this happens, because the film is so much not about story, but it's like, I think it's when they, maybe it was their first journey when they travel up river and they go to the quote unquote kings, you know, to have some dialogue with the king. Right. And I feel, and they're, I can't even remember the words, but I feel like it's like the Europeans are just like grabbing stuff like off of the tribe. Like there's leaves drying or there's food or something, and they're just like taking it for themselves, and the narration is I wish I could remember, I should have written it down exactly, but I guess my point is there's like these really interesting, almost humorous ironies, except that they're kind of you know, that they're illustrating pretty negative things, but they're almost strangely humorous in the just the you know, how matter-of-factly the contrast are laid out, right? Just how the irony is just so bold in a couple spaces there. I don't know if you felt any of that, but I guess in a similar way that the contrast or almost the visual irony of the beauty, but what happens in the story, which is a lot of what you described, right? It's kind of illustrating a lot of different things, but the one that you specifically mentioned about humans' growing disconnection to nature, right? And there's a lot of melancholy and sadness there, and the conflict between these two groups of people. And of course, again, having the knowledge of history that we know now and what that ended up turning into, right? Basically a genocide, ultimately. And of course Malick would have known this as well. I mean, he's obviously would be in his mind, I would assume, as well as an artist. So I don't know where I'm quite going with this. Maybe you can help me articulate it more clearly, but I guess I just really noticed this, that contrast is very interesting to me and used to great effect in this film.
Well, I think that the thing that interests me too, and I think something that I got very strongly this time was, and again, like you said, forgive me if I'm you know, all over the place here, because I'm kind of working this out as I say.
Hey, you know what? No. It's okay. It's like this conversation will be in the style of one of Malick's films, right? It's like a collage. It's like a collage of, just imagine this as like a collage of, you know, conflicting and contrasting comments that kind of coalesce into buy a ticket, man, and take the ride and just feel it. Don't try to understand it analytically. Just go with the flow.
Just feel what we're saying. Yeah. But no, I think that it's interesting in, because there's this kind of, especially through history, there has been this overarching kind of dogma that the European settlers showed up, and that there were these, you know, Stone Age people that were civilized, right? And that's kind of the
narrative for a while. I think it's been a long time since that's been accepted, but for a period of time,
this film, that's what they're,
well, that's what the assuming, Europeans right? at that like time that, felt. That's what they felt. It would have been, oh, these are primitives. They, you know, and we're, you know, part of that kind of, you know, I guess like rationalization for taking, you know, somebody else's land and home is that, okay, we're going to civilize you, and, you know, you don't know Christianity? Well, boy, we're here to introduce that to you as well. You know, I think that was the mindset of that era for sure.
Or even like, you don't know how to build a wall, like, you know, a defensive fort. Mm. And it's this interesting thing, because I think especially so in the last 30 years, as there used to be in kind of academic circles, this question of like, well, okay, well, why was, you know, despite the fact that they were around for as long as we were, you know, why was European culture so, or, you know, technology so much more advanced than you know, the indigenous people in the Americas, which across the board is not even that true. There were cities especially in Mesoamerica. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing is that this is where Malick, I think, is really brilliant in this film, and what he's doing is that he's showing that just because technology may be more advanced, what does that mean about life and feeling? How does that make it superior? Because then you get to London near the end of the film, and everything's gray, and the people are, you know, just, there's, where is the life and the energy there? And you meet these kings, the king and the queen, in this ornate hall, and yet it feels so sterile and so dead. And then you have that wonderful sequence where they're walking around those manicured gardens, and the trees are perfectly formed and shaped, and it's like, it just feels completely lifeless. And so I think what he does here, which I think is really, you know, brilliant, is just that he's challenging this idea of this like European you know, enlightenment. And it's like, enlightenment for what sake? You know, progress for what sake? Progress in air quotes. Because it seems like, you know, on a large scale, that these, like you said, it what did it lead to other than genocide, really? And why is it that there's this understanding or this belief that you know, technological advancement will necessitate happier lives or more fulfilled lives? And I think that that's really what we're looking at here in this grand sense. You know, even when you get to the palace in London, for example, and there's this, you know, incredible architecture, it kind of, you like, that's one of those things that if you're on vacation and you're in one of these old cities and stuff like that, you're kind of like, oh wow, this architecture is incredible. But after so long of looking at the trees and the meadows and the marshes and the rivers, it almost pales in comparison to, like, this beautiful architecture pales in comparison to the natural beauty of this. And I think that he's very intentionally shooting this way. You know, he's very intentionally showing the natural beauty as beautiful, because of course there are certainly natural places that are gray and drab and stuff in the world. Yeah. And yet I think that it's about just this feeling of being alive and being connected. And that's kind of what I think got the most out of this time.
Get, Yeah, something else I think I want to add to that, you know, because I think one of the wonderful things about Malick's films and the New World, of course, as well, is that he really invites you as the viewer to bring yourself to the film, and he gives so much space for interpretation, for active interpretation. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy that about his films. And I think you could likely watch this film numerous times, and each time you watch it, you could come away with something different being, you know, kind of your prominent takeaway, so to speak, from that, you know, from the film, from that viewing. And certainly, I think if you sat down 100 people and they watched this film and you asked them what it was about or what statement is Malick making, what do you think his perspective is? I mean, there would be some consistencies, but I think there'd be a lot of different answers too. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that about this film. Even though, you know, and even though you say, well, hey, it's very clear that Malick is kind of using these two groups of people to contrast, you know, one group being closer to nature and one group being kind of more leaning into technology and being somehow more removed or distant from nature. And I think that certainly you could make a strong argument for that, you know, and you list some, you know, different ways that you feel like Malick has kind of shot and illustrated that. I find it, you know, this in this viewing, one of the things that stood out to me so much was this almost Romeo and Juliet romance. And I hadn't really noticed how almost kind of Romeo and Juliet it is in a way, right? It's kind of like these star-crossed lovers, but they come from different groups and they can never be, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically. Yeah. And it's so, first of all, I just want to say that this, the way that Malick has shot, like the first half of this film is almost kind of like a falling in love story, basically. Yes. And I think that's where you say, and then kind of like once John Smith leaves, it kind of becomes much more melancholy. Mm-hmm. Once that relationship is no longer the focus of the film.
For both characters as well.
Yes. And we don't see Colin Farrell's John Smith as much. We focus on, I think it's Koryanka Kilcher. I hope I pronounced that correctly. If not, I apologize. Focus on her and her kind of descent into melancholy and almost, I don't know, say insanity, but her descent into a separation or disassociation, right? Where she's an alien, a stranger in a strange land. She's separated from her tribe. She's been given away and she has no home here in this strange place, right? And she wishes for death even. But I want to go back to the first half real quickly, because it's one of the things that struck me the first time and it struck me again this time is that it might be one of the most beautifully conceived falling in love stories in cinema that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Just capturing the emotion of what it's like to fall in love and bringing that to us in such a beautifully abstract but also surprisingly specific way is just really extraordinary. I mean, it's like, you know, I always kind of leads me at a loss, but I don't know if that's, but so that Romeo and Juliet kind of storyline almost stood out more to me in this viewing. And I kind of focused a little bit more on that, but I think he uses that relationship really beautifully that, like, you know, it's almost like we can come close, right? You can kind of like, you can come close to kind of fully empathizing with a different way of existence, but ultimately we're kind of still bound by our fates, right? Mm-hmm. We're kind of still bound by where you grew up and how you grew up and the culture in which you grew up. And you can't really ever leave that ultimately. Mm-hmm. No, neither of the two of them can. And maybe you can go so far as to never be able to be kind of come back to your own culture, but you also can never really be accepted by this new culture. And ultimately what happens to that, the character who's in that situation in this film, is that she dies.
Yeah. Now you're an outsider also to your original culture as well.
Well, and it's interesting too, because when she dies, it isn't some melodramatic, horrible thing. She's
actually quite beautiful.
Yeah, she's reborn at the end of the film. And it's interesting that he films that where she is back in nature and clearly ecstatic, doing cartwheels and dancing and twirling, but she's in the European dress. And of course, we end on this extraordinarily beautiful shot up at the trees, and it's, you know, cut right after the bird leaves the tree. And boom, we're in credits. So
well, I
don't know. So I feel like that really stood out to me, personally, more than kind of what you were, what seems to have stood out maybe more prominently to you, which is like, great, that's awesome. I feel like that's a sign of a really great work of art, you know, is that there can be so many interesting and deep interpretations. But I don't know, so that just stood out to me. And I was curious, like, what your feelings or thoughts were on that aspect of the film, their relationship.
Well, it's interesting, too, though, because I think that this story of Pocahontas and John Smith has been so, it's been told so many times. And this is one of, I think, you know, I've seen several adaptations, of course, haven't seen every adaptation, but this has got to be the only one I've ever seen that has truly, like, it's not overindulgent in its depiction of these things. It explores the emotional truth better than anything else. I think the reason for that is because it's very honest with itself about, you know, I noticed in the behind the scenes special features, they talk specifically about avoiding the trope of the, like, so-called noble savage, where it's like, okay, you get there, and that these people living with the land are so much more, like, gracious and noble.
Yeah.
Like, no, they have their problems, and the Europeans have their problems. And because of that subtlety, you kind of get this very honest, not dour, but again, I'm going to go back to Koinis Katsi in this way, where it's like, it's not cynical about it. It's more expressive about the flaws of humanity and how we are susceptible to so many different errors. And yet that's what kind of makes us human. And that also is what makes us, if anything, more a part of that nature. Even at the end, I think when Smith and Pocahontas meet up in England and they're having their conversation, and it's like, you know, that this, those times that we spent together it's the only truth. You can take that so many different ways. You can take that as, again, you can take that in this sort of nature-based way that I sort of read it as, but you can also take that as like the truth of our, you know, the emotional truth of our relationship, and that it's like, what does he mean by the only truth? Well, you know, perhaps he's saying it's irreplaceable, that we can try and get that back, but that was kind of, those circumstances were so specific and so perfect for us. And so there's this layer of tragedy to it, but it's beautiful tragedy. It's this really, I think, you know, you're not, again, you've mentioned Romeo and Juliet, and there's so many great adaptations of that as well. And I find almost the worst adaptations of Romeo and Juliet are the ones that get so melancholic and so downtrodden with the ending, rather than this really beautiful exploration of this relationship. And so I think when, you know, I think arguably the most beautiful point in the film is as she dies. And she describes to Christian Bale's character, John Rolfe, I believe his name is. Lots of Johns in this movie.
Yeah.
And she says, essentially, she like completely accepts it. Like, you've got this moment of, like you said, rebirth, where throughout the majority of the final half of the movie, you can tell that she is dying. If not physically, emotionally, she's dying.
Yeah.
She's getting depressed, and she's unused to where this world that she's now thrust into, and yet you have this renaissance right before she dies of, perhaps this all was beautiful, like perhaps this journey that I went on was the point, and that's what's beautiful about it, and that everyone has to die, you know, we all have to die, and that she goes completely with accepting that fate, and almost in that returns to what she found the most beautiful about life. And like you said, that you end on this beautiful shot of the trees and the bird flying off. And I think that to me is the best kind of, you know, rounding out of this story that I've seen. And that's why I kind of say that it's I think, the, if anything, the perfect adaptation of that story, because it is so subtle and it is so, so complicated, even though it's not a complicated, you know, plot, so to say. It's incredibly complex emotionally. That doesn't mean that it's not clear. That doesn't mean that it's not, it's difficult to understand, but it's complicated. It's deep. It's got so much richness to the way that it describes these emotions.
It's not complicated in like, it's not like, you know, like you said, it's not got all of these convoluted plot mechanizations that so many, you know, stories have, which I think are just like red herrings for complexity. Like, that's just not, for me, it's not interesting. Convoluted plots over complications, twists at the, you know, movies that rely on a twist. I'm not generally captivated by those films. Mm-hmm. I mean, this film is actually, the plot itself is very simple. The things that the concepts or ideas that this film is exploring aren't, they're universal, which in one sense makes them simple, but also they're like endlessly deep in so far as that they affect all of us and they are profoundly impacting on all of our lives. And so so I guess that's, you know, just kind of riffing off what you're saying there is that, yeah, I mean, I think that that this film is speaking to really deep universal truths or aspects of the human condition. And of course, like you said, it's using this historical scenario as just a mechanism for illustrating or discussing or, you know, asking questions about that, those aspects of the human condition, you know? It's like, it's, for example, it's not trying in any way, shape, fashion, or form to tell the historically accurate story of, you know, John Smith and when he came over and created, you know, that's like, no, it's in Pocahontas. And yeah, it's not, I don't think it really cares too much about that at all.
No,
frankly.
No, it's about, I mean, that's the thing about, I think, most of Malick's films, especially ones that are kind of built around a historical event. Like The Thin Red Line, I mean, the book is famously fictional. The book is about the Battle of Guadalcanal, but none of the events in the book are real. It's about a fictional troop of soldiers.
Yeah.
And so I think that you, when you do that, when you don't worry about it, again, it's kind of funny because it just gets right back to our conversations about Herzog, which is just like truth versus fact, whereas you're getting much more emotional truth out
and
of
a
this.
Landscape of the soul.
Landscape of the soul, by presenting it this way and by presenting the emotional truth of the events rather than the you know, historical accurate events. And I think Malick is also a really fascinating filmmaker because he's endlessly interested in these characters that are like, it's, I hesitate to say the word fish out of water because it's not that at all. It's more like there's in most, if not all, of his movies, there's always one or two characters. And in this one, it actually almost switches from John Smith to Pocahontas when she gets to kind of is taken into the colony.
Yeah.
But there's always this, he loves to have this one character that is seemingly
estranged
and in touch with something that everyone around them isn't, and comes to this learning and this understanding that that's not a curse. It's kind of, in a sense, you know, a for lack of a better term, a blessing in that way. And you know, in The Thin Red Line, we get that with Fife. I think is it Fife? Is it maybe, or Wit or whatever? There's so many different characters in that movie.
It's okay. I wish I could help you, but we get the idea.
This beautiful ending to that movie where, of course, he just kind of accepts his death as he's seen the world in the most beautiful ways for as it is. And he's had his cup filled, for lack of a better term. And in this, it's kind of the same thing where we have this character on her deathbed just going with complete peace and harmony, and John Smith as well kind of accepting that they had what they had, they've experienced those experiences, and that if you try to artificially bring those experiences back and those feelings back, that you're not going to get anywhere, you're not going to find that happiness again. You kind of have to go on to new things. As scary as it can be, you have to kind of venture out into the unknown of those emotions. And I think that that's You know, I just think that it's a really universal, like you said, universal way to look at things. I want to talk briefly too about the score of the movie, both James Horner's score and the music that Malick uses in it. And that, I think one of the things that sucked me into this movie immediately when I first saw it was the use of Wagner. I love Wagner. Mm-hmm. Especially the prelude, the Das Rheingold prelude, which comes
much
back
to, much to Horner's chagrin, by the way.
Yes, much to James Horner's chagrin. And we'll talk about that a little bit too, because it's actually an interesting kind of technical side of working with them. But you've got the Das Rheingold prelude, which comes in three times, I believe. The movie starts and ends with it, which I think is a beautiful piece of music. I've used it in like a million things of my own. And it just has that feeling of like your brain waking up, like you're like the world turning on and coming to life. And I think that that's so appropriate for this, because it's like, it's enlightenment, not in the sense of like enlightened era. It's enlightenment in this being in touch with kind of this natural, I don't know, energy. I sound like a voodoo guy or something like that. but this,
like,
but
a new age. You sound like a new age practitioner.
But it does give you that kind of sense of feeling as they roll into these marshes and these meadows at the very beginning of the film on their big ships, and that there's like, it truly does encapture this feeling of like what it would have been like to land somewhere in this complete unknown, in this and be breaching out into this quite scary but also quite incredible moment in mm-hmm. One's life from like an individual perspective. But then, yes, like you mentioned, there's also the James Horner score, which I think is actually really lovely. I have that on my phone as well, and on Apple Music or whatever. James Horner famously not very happy with his experience, because of course, as Malick is, chopped up the score and used bits of it in other places, and James Horner kind of said that he
didn't use a lot of his score at all.
And he'd written a very specific kind of story with that music, and Malick, of course, as Malick does, used it sparingly in places where he wanted it. But I actually do like the James Horner score, but it's interesting too, because that kind of, I think, is kind of the recurring theme with working with Malick, is Christopher Plummer also has a conversation an actor's round table, where he describes that he would never work with Malick again, because in this film, you know, he would be delivering a monologue and Malick would run off with the camera to go film a bird in a tree or something. And I think that it's funny, because you just kind of see this dichotomy of people who really love working with Malick. Like, I think Christian Bale, who's worked with him several times, loves it. Colin Farrell speaks about this experience as a really, really wonderful experience. Hans Zimmer, who did the score for The Thin Red Line, speaks... Jesus, what was that? Sorry. Positively about it. He speaks very... he talks about how The Thin Red Line was just basically making a tapestry of music for Malick, as opposed to a structured story with the music. And so I think you just kind of get into this really... Again, not only... I think at the beginning I had said that Malick was challenging the kind of the conventions of narrative, and had challenged the conventions of like studio filmmaking, but you also get that not only on the receiving end of an audience, but on the technical side of making the film, that you are making a movie that is unlike the production on, I think, pretty much anything else, which I think is really interesting. I mean, like, why feel the need to be so formalistic about it?
I mean, especially, you know, now in the almost 20 years since this film's release, we see where cinema has gone since this film has been released. And it's, you know, I think we've asked this of several films that we have discussed in our podcast. And, you know, I'll ask it again of this one. I mean, can you really imagine this film having a wide theatrical release in today's day and age, you know? I would posit the hypothesis that it would be very, very unlikely. And frankly, it's even surprising that that a studio funded this film's major, you know, a theatrical release.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Even regardless of theatrical release, would this movie even get the funding, period, to be
would it even get the funding period sense. Of course yeah of course. I mean it's maybe a 30 million ish budget. I think it made its money back, but you know, it's interesting to note that, you know, critical reception of the film is not exceedingly high. Mm-hmm. And is very split. Just kind of going back and looking at like a brief overview of critical response at the time, you know, you have a group of critics just being, you know, just profoundly moved by the film and, you know, claiming it to be one of the best of, you know, the decade, you know, at the time. And then you have other reviewers who were like, what's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. Which I can imagine that this would be a divisive film. I can imagine a lot of audiences expecting, especially if they're expecting a traditional like epic narrative, historical epic narrative film, are going to be disappointed. But I guess it makes sense. I can imagine that that this film would be divisive. But I'm especially interested in those reviews or those critics who seem to get it, who seem to, you know, catch that vibe. And I mean, it's when they, I think you don't see many reviews that are inspired to a level of like poetry. Like if you go and if you read some of the reviews of this film, it's almost like these critics were inspired themselves to, you know, to achieve a poetry of their explanation for why they liked it. You know, I mean, it's like, do you know what I mean? It's almost like the experience was so inspiring that their review is clearly inspired when you read it, you know, because it's elevated even their writing and the review somehow, the experience, you know, which I find fascinating.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that it's definitely, like you said, I understand the level of people not necessarily being able to connect with it, but perhaps just it not being their thing.
Yeah.
But it's funny because it is just I think I said this in our Thin Red Line review or conversation where I described that I could watch a like 10-hour cut of this and would be completely happy with that. So it is very much up my alley in that sense.
Well, and you know, and again, it's like, I mean, this is the wonder of cinema, right? Is that there's something out there for everyone. You know, before we kind of wrap up, I kind of want to, you know, talk about, and I'm curious, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm curious if you know more about this. When I watch the film, I've not read a lot or seen a lot of discussion on how Malick works. Actually, mm-hmm. like literally works, how he prepares for a film, how he, you know, how he works actually during production and how he involved he is in the editing. God, I mean, I would imagine I'm surprised, honestly, that it's not like edited by him. You know, I see here listed there are four editors in the credits. Yeah. And so I'm curious, you know, what that means. But it's almost, you know, the feeling that I get when I'm watching the film, if I kind of take a step out, right, and kind of, okay, I'm outside of the film as far as like just looking at it being impacted emotionally, and I'm kind of looking at the mechanics of the film and imagining how it might have been put together. I mean, it almost seems like he has just shot it in a collage kind of way, right? I mean, I can almost imagine him out there like, oh my God, this is beautiful. We need to get the, you know, let's come over mm-hmm. here and let's get a shot of this lake. Let's get a shot of this tree. Oh, you know, let's, you know, there are often just these shots of characters just looking straight into camera, you know, just these almost look like just stills basically. And, you know, there's all these different pieces, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's almost like as he's like, just whatever kind of comes to him, let's, you know, we've got a script, yes, but, you know, and it's just, it almost feels like this was built by collage, you know, and then he kind of, mm-hmm. but I may be totally wrong. It's just how it kind of feels. And then it gets into the editing and it's like, okay, where does this feeling kind of take us? And it's almost, I wonder if he edits almost in the way that we described, you have to kind of watch the film, which is, okay, I'm not worried about literal story. Yes, there has to be some of that, but I'm really worried about emotional impact. And so it's just how am I, it's almost like it's this very intuitive sense that I get that he works from. And I don't know, but it almost just gets that feeling that it's like he's just grabbing shots, just things that move him in the moment. This is beautiful, that's beautiful, or this or that. And then he kind of goes back into editing and it's like, okay, I'm gonna go where this flow where my feelings kind of take me, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's totally, I mean, I think that he, from my understanding, is that basically the way that he shoots the film is he has people in character all the time and he will just approach them. And that's why the set has to be so extensive as well. Like the building of the set was basically authentic.
Yeah, you can't just have the front built and then nothing behind.
So,
yeah,
so that he could just walk around and find moments and that every actor would just basically be in character.
Wow.
They would do a scene, then he would move on to something else while simultaneously having all these choices of where to go.
Yeah.
And then the edit, I'm more familiar with the process on The Thin Red Line, but I would guess that it would be pretty similar to this because The Thin Red Line also has, I think, 4 or 5 editors.
Okay.
From my understanding is each editor basically takes a section of film and works on that extensively for the entire process. So they're not actually cutting the whole film.
Oh,
each editor is just cutting sections.
Okay, and I was
that
curious.
That way Malick is able to give very specific instructions on what he wants for, and they essentially will cut together without Malick being there, viewing kind of, I guess, work prints for him. And then he will watch those, make suggestions, make cuts and on his own and kind of change things up, and then we'll go back and let them kind of continue to form it. And so in doing so, it basically allows these different pathways to form with the movie, because there's different perspectives on where it should go and things like that. So then
right.
at the end, it's kind of all smoothed out and formed into the final thing. But
interesting.
Yeah, at least that's, I know for sure how he did it on The Thin Red Line. And again, I would guess that that would be similar for here because there are a number of editors. So so it's quite interesting. I know that he also likes to basically edit like as long as he, like as close to release as he can.
Yeah.
He's still making it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that the score was chopped up so much is because that he was making very big changes to things.
Right.
Well, and actually the one version of this movie I've not seen is the first cut, like the original cut that was released for Oscar contention. Basically they released it for a 2-week window in like 3 theaters just so it could get into
it's in the Criterion Collection
and so I think I might watch that afterwards.
I think that I might as well too. I would be very curious because I'm pretty sure, you know, well I'm certain that, you know, when I originally saw the film, I saw the theatrical cut, you know, that would have been released just on, I guess, DVD back in 2005, and then this time, of course, we watched the extended cut, like we said. So I could, because there was so much time between watching the theatrical cut and this cut, I can't quite put my finger on what those changes were. Although it did seem like there were, I was like, oh, this, you know, I didn't have a recollection of this aspect of the film or something. But really, I couldn't put my finger on it. So I have no idea how this first cut might be different. So I'd be very interested to see that and to see how different it might be.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, and that's one of the fascinating things about making a movie like that is that kind of exploration in using editing as the writing process, and kind of working out so many different things. And it's not about, you know, at least the way I look at it, it's not about the hesitance to make decisions on set, but rather just a different form of that process. And I think the reason that I value that a lot is, I think, because people get so stuck into how things are done on film. Like if you've ever worked on a film set or ever been involved in the production of something,
people
are like, and oftentimes don't have a better answer as to why things are done other than that's just how things are done. And so I think that having someone challenge that, you're obviously always going to get pushback, and clearly Malick does get a lot of pushback from critics and people that he's worked with alike. And yet you can't really fault him for the quality of the
output, the
pictures that he comes out with. Right. So,
I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. You know, I've not made a narrative film like this, but I have experience with documentary work, and it just, for myself, in my own mind, it almost kind of feels like the way that I would work with a documentary where I would basically set out with a question for myself as opposed to an answer. And you use the production time to explore the question, whatever this, you know, whatever thing I'm curious about. And then when I'm in editing, it's really an exploration of that. And I don't know where it's going to go, you know, at all. I don't have some pre-planned, you know, okay, this is going to be the first act and here's the second and then the third. I mean, I might have certain milestones kind of etched out in my, or, you know, sketched out in my mind, but really could go anywhere. And and I don't even know where it might go. And so I don't know, as listening to you kind of describe what your awareness is of his process does kind of sound like, oh, that kind of sounds like how I like to work, at least in the documentary space. And so,
and it's fascinating too, because it kind of also goes again to that Herzog level where, like, Herzog describes the fact that he doesn't make narrative films and documentaries in any
storyboards are for cowards, except did like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something instead of, you do a good Herzog. I'm horrible.
Yeah, we could go back. But no, I think that it's really fascinating though to kind of take that out of it and sort of say, like, well, I'm not doing this narrative picture like a narrative picture. I'm just doing it in the way that I want to tell a story, and in a similar sense, I'm not doing this documentary like a documentary. I'm doing it to express something, to express a point of view, and however that comes about is how it comes about. And rather than having to divide, make some distinction between the processes of the two. So I think, I think that's really, really neat. And I think it shows itself on the screen in a very unique way. And I'm, you know, I love it.
Yeah.
Can't say much else other than, I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I figure that's as good a note to end on as any. I do too. I think that the world of cinema is a better place for Malick. And his, I need to rectify the fact that I have not seen his other films. So, but that's great. It's like, it's really fun to have, like, my watch list is always just growing, you know, it's like endless. And, I guess that's one of the, you know, there won't be enough time in my life to see all the films that I would like to see, but they're on my list. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, as always, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I feel like I was a little less articulate in this conversation than I often am, or at least I imagine I am. Maybe I'm I'm
like
never articulate.
We have to feel.
Yeah, and maybe that's just indicative of the nature of this film, that it's, you know, so there you have it. Anyway, I'll look forward to your pick, whatever that might be, for our next episode. And everybody out there listening, we appreciate you. Thanks for doing so. We'll catch you next time.